My name is Vern Rieke,
R-I-E-K-E,
and I am a teacher at the University of Washington School of Law. I've taught law there for a long time. Jane and I live in Seattle, and we've been here at Holden for the last week, and happy to have a chance to talk about law with you. The thing that I'd like to try and work through with you tonight is how the legal system operates. What it does, what we expect of it, what kind of tools are available in law, and how they are used, and why it's that way. I don't remember exactly, but was it Montesquieu who once said that in the United States, all questions finally wind up as questions of law? We seem, among all the nations in the world, to have a greater predilection for resorting to litigation than almost any other country. There are probably more lawyers in the state of Washington than there are in all of Canada. I'm sure there are more lawyers in California than there are in Canada. This is because we simply feel that ultimately the test lies with the judiciary. That's one reason. Another reason is that in the last few decades, our other agencies, thinking of the legislative bodies and of the executive, have seemed to be less and less able to resolve problems and have the resolutions accepted. And I'd like to illustrate that just very briefly. With reference to our executive agencies and the administrative bodies, those of us who live in the United States seem to be doubting the value and validity of governmental processes. We question whether or not the president, the governor, the senators, the legislators, other persons are really to be relied upon, depended upon, more than we have, I think, in our earlier history. There is a slogan that I see painted on buildings every once in a while, question authority. I suspect that Leo Bustead, sitting behind, hiding behind the post over there, who is currently a dean, had the same experience that I did for a few years when I was deaning. People question authority. The more people, the more questions. With reference to the legislating process, legislators of necessity, congressmen of necessity, must respond to their constituency. If they don't, they don't return to their legislative responsibilities. That means that in some fashion or other, proposed legislation has to get back to the voter. The voter has to understand what is going on. The voter must in some way respond to the legislative process and say to the congressman or to the legislator or to the city councilman or whoever it is, I want you to settle this problem this way. That's an educational process in there that takes time. And problems arise with such speed now. For all the blessings that science gives us, they also give us in the accelerated pace of discovery and new problems, less time to resolve our problems than we had before. Moses and those that came afterwards could sit in the desert or the wilderness and think about something for 10, 20 years and nothing would change. Still be the same flock of sheep wandering around the same hills. That simply is not true of our society today. Something must be done about problems. And if we wait for legislative response, it's apt to be that a bill will be introduced one session and talked about a little bit, and then it will be reintroduced in the next session, and a little bit more work done. And finally, maybe the third session, there will be enough understanding on the part of the people who are involved in the process, and maybe even the constituency, so that an enactment may be made. And by that time, we may all be dead of pollution or lack of water or something else. The relative lack of response in the last couple decades of the legislating process and the lack of confidence that we've felt in our executive branch of government has created a situation in which we force the courts to respond to problems that ought never to be in the courts. They are, in fact, not judicial problems, but they are forced into the judicial process for the simple reason that answers must be reached, and we do not yet have a process which can act rapidly enough to respond to those issues in a way in which people have confidence and are willing to accept the decisions that are made. That's why, a few years ago, you saw people going around carrying signs saying, impeach Earl Warren, then the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. People said, quite accurately, that the court was handing down decisions which were sociologically based, rather than decisions which were based upon some statute or some other rule which came from our normal rule-making processes. People said quite accurately that it's the function of a court to decide questions under the legal process, not to make up rules. And I suppose that's your thinking, I suppose. Judges are supposed to be guided by rules. Rules that have been developed by our legal processes or by legislative bodies. Judges are not supposed to make the law, they're supposed to apply it. Or isn't that the way that you understand the process? Maybe I've assumed too much. But I think that's the way most people feel about it. So one of the questions we've got to answer tonight is, can we continue with this process of demanding from our courts answers to problems which really are political in their nature without burning out the last of the processes that we have available to us in the sense of destroying people's confidence in the judicial process? Judges have no taxing power. They do not have a police force. They do not have an army. When a judge orders something to be done, there is no way that a judge can enforce that. It's got to be enforced by the executive branch of government through its police department or its police powers. We have relied historically upon the willingness of people to do what the judge says they ought to do, because there was a vote of confidence that the courts, by and large, are working fairly, that there is a kind of a justice operating there, and people responded voluntarily. And I ask you to think for just one moment now, before we start tackling how that process works, about what's happening to us today. A court, for example, orders the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization to return to work because they have contracted to do that and have promised, in that instance, even under oath, that they would not strike, and the court is simply ignored. Policemen, those people who work for government agencies, firemen, and so down through a long list of persons simply ignore restraining orders from courts because they say, well, we must strike, we must negotiate, we must bargain, and we are not going to accept an order from the court telling us what to do. At this point in the process, you see, we are indeed in danger of making ineffective the last of the rapid dispute settling mechanisms that we have. So what I want to think about with you tonight is, can we better perceive how the legal process works, and perhaps in that understanding, regain some sense of confidence about the validity of the process? And I do not intend to engage in special pleading. I will not at this point try and persuade you that lawyers are all fair and equitable and great guys. I will not try and persuade you that there are no corrupt judges. I will try and persuade you that it is a system which still has some real utility to us and is badly needed. That's what I intend to shoot at tonight. Before I tackle that issue, at least one comment over here.
I was thinking, you said that the court doesn't have operate on the terms of, say, police power. In making an injunction, doesn't it almost move over to the executive area?
All right, it really does not.
I see.
A court has three tools available to it. And I think this was responsive to your question. And that's just about all that a court can do. A court can announce a fact. This car belongs to John Jones and it does not belong to Richard Rowe. This child is the lawful child of this man and this woman and not of that man and that woman. Simply announcing a fact. That's number one. A court can change some relationship. This man and this woman are not married. The judge gets up and he mumbles a little bit. Now they are married. You've simply changed a basic relationship from single to being married. And as you all know, you can reverse that process and take a couple that's married and make them single. Or you can take a child that's the child of John and Jane Doe, and by depriving them of that child and placing the child for adoption with Richard Rowe and Rachel Rowe. The child used to be the child of these people, now it's the child of these people. And in changing that kind of status, and of course there are hundreds of those, citizenship and so forth, there are hundreds of those status changes that can be decreed by the court, and in doing that you set off a whole train of consequences. Because you are married, your tax is different, your exemptions from claims of creditors is different, your inheritance is different, your citizenship may be different, down through hundreds of things that are based upon the status. So when you change the status, you set off a whole new track of collateral consequences. Change of status, that's the second thing. You can announce a fact, number one, you can change a status, number two. Third, and directly responsive to your question, now you can order that something is done. But a judge can't enforce that himself, unless he's got big muscles and is an awful active guy, and of course we don't ask judges to do that, you've got to call on the sheriff or the marshal or the home guard or somebody else. And sometimes, because we are a government of equal and separate branches of government, the executive, the legislative, the judicial, sometimes orders don't get enforced. I'll give you probably our most scary illustration. During the Civil War, a time when the United States Supreme Court's prestige was the lowest it's ever been in our history, for historical reasons that I will not pursue at the moment because it takes too long, but the court was indeed in low esteem at that point, much like it was a few years ago, and even worse. During that time, the President of the United States, Abraham Lincoln, without resorting to trial, threw in prison a colonel in the army simply because Lincoln disagreed with the colonel's policies. The colonel asked for a writ of habeas corpus. It's essentially what the Magna Carta was all about. I'm entitled to be tried before I'm put in prison. The Constitution of the United States clearly says so. No man shall be deprived of his life or his liberty without due process. Court looked at it and said, well, this is a very obvious case. You've got a man in prison who's never had a trial of any sort. Let him out. The President of the United States said no. The court said, we order you not to deprive this person of his freedom without due process. And the President of the United States responded, now whose army are you going to use? And the man stayed in prison. A couple of years ago, I was talking to the man who handled the trials when President Nixon was in difficulty. The question was, shall the court of the United States be asked to order the president to release the tapes of the conversations in his office? The problem for the person handling that trial was not whether or not the court would order the release of those tapes. That you could predict with some accuracy. There was adequate legal basis precedent so that you could predict that the court would order the release of the tapes. The question was whether or not the order, if entered, would be obeyed. And that's the problem, you see, because we have so carefully built a system of checks and balances that we can, with a little effort, checkmate ourselves into chaos. And in one way, my message for you on this first session that we spend together this week is that we're not so far away from doing that. It's time for us to think rather seriously as to whether or not our processes will in fact work. Let's talk about how they operate. Let's take a simple thing. Do you think that you can be involved in a baseball game without being simultaneously involved in legal process? I don't mean the baseball strike of a few weeks ago. I mean just a good, friendly game of baseball. Is that an exercise in law? Take an illustration. We have a man in a blue suit standing behind the catcher who's leaning over, and he's watching the pitcher who winds up and flings the ball toward the catcher, and the man in the blue suit looks at it and he announces that that is a strike. And 5,000 people in the stands boo and shout and throw pop bottles and say, clearly that was a ball. I remember in Seattle we used to have a center fielder who stood out there 5.5 miles away from home base, you know. And every time the umpire called one he didn't like, he'd yell, it looked pretty good from here. Suppose that you know that there is television being taken of this game and that there can be instant replay. And you know that the films will show whether that thrown ball went between the edges of the plate, above the kneecap, and below the shoulder. You know that that's true, that the film will show that. Is that a relevant fact? Does it make any difference? Does it matter where the ball went? Does it? What is a strike in baseball? I don't mean the people refusing to work. I mean, what is a strike as distinguished from a ball, from a pitcher? I'm sorry?
What the umpire calls it.
Does that give you a chill? You see, I'm going to be tormenting you now for a half an hour and a little bit more as to whether or not something is true or not true, just depending upon what somebody calls it. Do we just hire the man in the blue suit and put him back there and say, you decide whether something is a strike or a ball, or do we hedge him in with some rules? Do we happen to have a professional baseball umpire in the...
You hedge him in that you can't challenge a decision on a ball and strike. You can challenge him on a base out, but you can't challenge the umpire without getting thrown out of the game.
Without getting thrown out of the game, that's true. But suppose
they have to have a certain amount of training ahead of time. They have to meet certain standards of the Baseball Referees Association.
Yes.
And then are assumed to, once they are assumed to have met these standards, then they are awarded to go in any given game. I don't know, but I would imagine if there is an umpire who gets many challenges through the official,
we may unseat him.
Yeah,
huh? Yeah. Yeah, we may remove him from his position.
Yeah, not in the middle of impeach him.
But do we give him any guidance as to, do we describe what a ball and is and a strike is?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can it, I went rattling on a moment ago. Have any of you ever read the rule book about what a strike is?
Yes.
Could you sort of tell us in your own words?
That was so long ago. There's a fairly long couple of paragraphs describing the area through which a ball must travel in order for it to be counted as a strike.
It's very critical at this point, Ricky, as to whether or not the rule says the area through which the ball must travel, or whether it says something about somebody's judgment about where the ball did travel. See, that's the big problem. And the rule book actually says that a thrown ball, which in the opinion of the umpire passes through that described space, you know, kneecap, shoulder, outer edges of the plate and so forth, which in the opinion of the umpire. Now let me ask my question once more. Can an umpire be wrong?
Can an umpire ever change his opinion because of
I've seen it.
In the midst of a game, but not after the fact. Once he comes
to take a shower,
it's all...
Has it ever affected the outcome of a game?
Not on balls and strikes, but on base running.
I'm sure all of you have seen games on television, say a football game, in which the big question is, did that runner step outside or did he not step outside? And you were watching television and you had a much better view than the umpire does. And you saw him step outside. And the next day in the newspapers, they print a photograph of the line and the foot, and he is outside, and there's no question, and the umpire said it was okay. Was it okay? You see, we must be very careful about this. We are not asking the question whether the person stepped across the line. We are asking the question of whether or not, in the opinion of the person who had the authority to make the decision, the ball went in that space or the person stepped across the line. Now that's important stuff. That's important stuff. There was a man by the name of Armstrong who owned a horse, really a rather nice horse, rather expensive horse. Case arose quite some time ago. Let's just put a value on the horse. Let's say this was an English case, in fact, and they gave a value in pounds. But let's say the horse is worth $500. So one day, Mr. Armstrong was riding into town, and he was to meet some friends, and he got there a little bit late, and he got off. And in kind of a, oh, it's all the horse's fault that I'm late, and it's a no-good horse, and that horse makes me so sick and tired, I'd sell him for $25. And Mr. McGee said, you really feel that way about your horse? And Mr. Armstrong said, yes, I feel that way about my dumb horse. And Mr. McGee says, I'll take him. And handed Armstrong $25. And Armstrong said, good riddance, you know. Mr. McGee took the horse out the next day and he rode it very hard, got it into a big lather, came back, gave it a bunch of cold water to drink, and the horse died. Armstrong said to McGee, you know, fun's fun, but that's carrying a joke too far. You knew as well as I did that we were just kidding each other. And now you've destroyed a very valuable horse, and you owe me $500. McGee said, nonsense, you sold me that horse. Armstrong said, oh, come off of it. Everybody knows a joke. McGee said, you weren't joking, and Armstrong said, I was too. McGee said, you were not, I was too, you were not. Now we got the makings of a lawsuit there. When two people are locked into an argument and McGee says, at the very most, I owe you $25 and I paid you that. And Armstrong says, that's true if I sold you the horse, but I did not sell you the horse. You owe me the difference between $25 and $500, $475. McGee refused to pay. Armstrong sued him. You are the judge. How do you rule on that case? Think about baseball. What's the issue? What do you have to decide? What factor here is going to shape your opinion?
The question is whether or not there's a contract.
Is that a question of fact, or is that a question of rules? Let me, before you even answer that, I'll give you just a second to think about it. When lawyers talk about rules, they are talking about what most people call laws. And that's all right, you go right ahead and call them laws, everybody else does. But for a lawyer, law means a process for accomplishing certain tasks. Rules are something that you use in accomplishing that tasks. A rule is to a lawyer who practices the art of law about the same thing as an aspirin tablet is to an MD who practices medicine. When I tell my brother that an aspirin tablet is medicine, he says, no, that's a pharmaceutical product. Medicine is diagnosis and making a decision about what to do and helping you get well. Sometimes it means an aspirin tablet, sometimes it doesn't mean an aspirin tablet. That's the practice of medicine, which incorporates sometimes the knife, sometimes the pill, sometimes sympathy, sometimes, oh, get out of here, you're just kidding me again. So I want to know in Armstrong and McGee whether the judge has before the bench a question of fact or a question about what a rule says.
Is it ever one or the other?
Must it always be both?
It would seem to me attempting to secure which rule and which facts are relevant to the case. I mean, the color of the horse is not a fact that's important.
No.
And rules about divorce are not important.
No.
But you pick out the rules about contracts and see how the facts relate to them.
I know that you haven't had a chance to read the opinion, you weren't there to hear the arguments and all of that sort of stuff. But do you suppose that the argument was, in fact, about what is a contract? And that's a sort of an ambiguous statement itself when I think about it. Do you suppose they were arguing about how you enter into a contract or whether or not they did enter into a contract?
Whether or not they did.
I'm sorry, I heard two or three at the same time. Yes.
I think whether or not they did, but then that would be...
Is that a fact or is that a rule of law? What do we have to decide in order to know whether or not they entered into a contract?
How you have to do that. I mean, the
okay.
rules that
suppose that I now give you, as a court will always do, as a judge will always do for a jury, I hereby instruct you that the law of contracts, those of you who have been on juries will remember that the judge always instructs the jury as to what the law is. I now instruct you that the law of contracts involves, number one, that the parties shall reach an agreement. And then there are some other things too. That's good enough for right now. Did the parties in Armstrong and McGee reach an agreement?
Sure. Yes.
Armstrong says they did not. Armstrong said, I was jesting, and you, McGee, knew that I was joking. When I said, I'll sell this dumb horse for $25, that's a joke. Everybody knew it was a joke. You knew it was a joke. I didn't expect to sell the animal. You didn't expect to buy it. Therefore, there never was a firm undertaking.
Then why did you get him a horse?
Yeah. A joke. A joke. I was bragging. I was showing off. I was being smart. Drunk. At the next day, McGee took the horse out, rode it hard. You know, Armstrong says, well, sure it was a joke. You were going to take the horse away. I was being funny. I expected you to bring my horse back to me the next day. How do you know whether that's true or not true?
Any witnesses?
You got people who were there, and the witnesses say, Armstrong came in, he got off, he was late. He said, dumb horse, made me late again, and he was blowing around, like I said before. No disagreement about what Armstrong said, no disagreement about what McGee said, no disagreement about the circumstances. All of that information, that evidence comes in. It's a wonderful case when you get evidence like that. Usually, when you get the evidence in, you know, how fast was the car going? One side says, well, I'd say about 90, and the other one says, well, maybe 15 miles an hour. I remember a judge, a fine judge in Washington, the name of McDonald, who was on the trial bench when I first started practicing. It's before we had mandatory retirement laws, and Judge Ronald was actually over 90 at that time. He wore a big green eye shade and could hardly see, and he didn't hear so well, and he had no teeth. Still a pretty good judge. But I can remember sometimes in cases of conflict of evidence this way, the judge would sit upright just when I thought he'd finally gone to sleep for sure. He'd sit up, and one day I saw him take his finger and he ran it around inside his gums like that and said, "I don't like this part, I don't like this, somebody's lying." That's not true, you know. Armstrong may very well have meant a joke. McGee may very well have thought this conversation was for earnest. Now what are you going to do? I call your attention to the fact that the one thing you cannot do is refuse to decide the problem. Judges must always decide the issue, no matter what the evidence is. You must always decide. The man who was the head referee in the last Rose Bowl game used to be a colleague of mine on the law school faculty, now practices law in Oregon. He's also a very good umpire, referee in a football game. He cost us the last game with a call the television later showed was not valid. And I said, "Bill, did you ever see that play?" And he said, "No." And I said, "But you called?" And he said, "Nobody else saw it either." He says, "The one thing that had to happen was the, you had to call it." So I called it. And I was tempted to say that, well, you were sure wrong, except that I know he wasn't. He couldn't be. He used an honest judgment. Well, he didn't have any facts. He didn't see anything. But from what little he heard and other general assumptions, he called it. He couldn't have been wrong. Do you understand what I'm saying about... Did Armstrong and McGee have a contract, or did they not?
Well, the question would be, is a verbal statement a contract?
If it is intended by the parties to be, and if the parties are entitled to believe that it is, I mean to illustrate a process in which a court is bound to determine a fact. Did the party intend? How fast was the car going? All of those issues. And what you got is a little bit of evidence. Now let's try another case.
You don't have to come to a conclusion on that.
Oh yeah, you got to come to a conclusion on that. McGee paid Armstrong the price of the horse. Don't know whether you like that one or not. Could come out the other way just as well. The state of Washington has what is known as an award in lieu of homestead. I'll tell you what that means, and you've got to understand it. This is an act of our legislature. The legislation is this, that if a man and a woman have married, and if they have lived together in the state of Washington, and if during their life together they have not claimed a homestead in their property. A homestead is a claim that you may make that exempts the property from claims of creditors. So that in the event that somebody is taking your property for debts or if somebody dies or something, the surviving spouse has an exempt ownership that can't be taken away from him or her. Okay? That's a homestead. The legislation, the award in lieu of homestead statute, says that if the parties did not claim a homestead during their married life, that upon the death of one of the spouses, the other spouse may claim an award. Used to be of $10,000, it's more now, an award in lieu of the homestead out of the property of the deceased spouse in the amount of $10,000. Okay? You all got the statute? Got it? All right. There was a man who had been married earlier in his life. He had a son who was 18 years of age. The son was a handicapped, severely handicapped person, totally dependent upon the father. Father at that time was approaching 50 years of age, had been a widower for some time. As I say, he had this 18-year-old son totally dependent upon him, a man of modest means. Never met him, a nice guy as far as I know. One day he met a woman, and after a period of courtship they married. They married in Seattle, Washington, about 8 o'clock in the morning. The man died of a heart attack that night, having been married maybe 8 hours or so. Didn't have much property, had a little. His widow claimed an award in lieu of homestead. Take every dollar that was in the man's estate. A guardian for the son appeared in opposition to the widow's claim. She said, well, I certainly am entitled to the award. We were married. During our joint life, we did not claim a homestead. I am the survivor, and I claim the award in lieu. Representative, the counsel for the boy, said, this boy will have no means of support. The father surely meant to support the son. The son's need is much greater than that of the widow. He ought to get the $10,000 rather than the widow. What problem have you as judge to resolve before you can decide how to go on that case? Is that the baseball case all over, or Armstrong McGee? What do you have to?
Does the will make any difference in this?
There was no will. And it wouldn't make any difference anyway, but that's all right. There was no will. You've got all the facts that you need to know. Nobody's arguing about the facts. Everybody agrees. Son is incompetent, man's married, they claim no award, no homestead. I mean, they claim no homestead during their joint life. He's dead, she's a widow. What do you have to decide? How will you decide that case?
Going to decide who needs it more.
You sound just like Mr. Chief Justice Earl Warren. But that's a compliment, not an insult. Are the rest of you comfortable about that? The judge can just say, oh, well, the legislature said this, but I'll do it the other way anyway. After all, don't pay any attention to the legislation.
No stipulation of how long they had been married. What a short time.
Not a thing.
It's a question of what the law says.
The law says, married, didn't claim a homestead, one dies, the other one survives, and the claim is made. That's what the law says.
There's no way the judge could sort of hang his hat on some other small technicality.
No small technicalities.
The wife will get it.
The wife's got to get it. And the judge on appeal said, you know, I'm sorry about this. This really tears me up. I hope the legislature will do something about this. But after all, I am a judge. I apply the law. I don't make it. If the legislature had wanted an exception in there, they would have put it in. I hope they do. The next session of the legislature, they did. But in the interim, I'm the judge. I am bound by the rule. And I'm a true, blue, loyal judge, and I'll do what the statute tells me. And he gave the money to the widow. And the son was simply out. Okay? That's the way it ought to go, isn't it?
But the law's no longer that way now? Or the rule?
Legislature changed it.
They changed it. Mm-hmm. So now what, the children can claim?
Yes, that's right. If there is a son or a child who is not provided for and needs the assets and is a minor, or is handicapped, the surviving spouse can't take it. But the judge made a right decision, didn't he? Mm-hmm. The judge shouldn't make the law, should he?
No.
Mr. Chief Justice dissenting? All right, are we all clear on that? The judge is bound by what the law says, okay? A few years after that case, a man one day took up an axe and killed his wife. He was not executed. He was sent to Walla Walla, one of our institutions here in the state. When he got down there, he realized that he was out of money to buy cigarettes and other things. And then he also realized that, by cracky, he was a surviving spouse. Well, you got the picture. He claimed an award of $10,000 in lieu of a homestead. He and his wife had never claimed an award in lieu of homestead. And he said, I'm a surviving spouse. We never claimed. We were married. We lived in this state. there's the case of the incompetent son. The legislature didn't say except murderers. And I want $10,000. And the other heirs said, judge, don't let him have it. Now what? Mr. Chief Justice, you dissented in the last case. Would you like to say something at this point?
In the loss of nothing but criminals.
Not a word. The man says, I admit that I'm a criminal. I murdered her. I shouldn't have done it. Happy to be here living in Walla Walla. I would like to have some cigarettes. If the legislature had intended an exception, they would have put it in. That's what the court, state Supreme Court said in the case of the incompetent son. Now what are you going to do?
There's some other laws that would apply to this that...
Keep working at it. You may have something productive there. You got legal process.
General law that would might apply to this specific
case. You see, you've got legal process working right in front of you now. You watch this. How are you going to do it?
Is there not a law that says that the person cannot benefit from their criminal activity?
Kind of.
Looking up other previous cases, perhaps. Try to find something that might apply.
They found the one of the incompetent son.
Let's face it, we don't want him to have the money, so we don't want for a rule no. That applies.
Here we are, we judges. We have now heard the case and we are in conference. We are a little bit bigger than the Supreme Court is most of the time, but we've come in and we have now decided that that fellow ought not to get the $10,000. Notice the way we've said that to each other. He ought not to get it. And then the question is, how are we going to keep him from getting
That's
it?
That's right. Get the legislatures out there.
The legislature, I assure you, at the very next session, took care of this one. The statute in the state of Washington dealing with awards in lieu of homestead is getting longer and longer and longer.
But he got the money.
Do we have to do that? Not bother you. I wonder if we could take a vote in here. Now, we, the state Supreme Court of the state of Washington, having heard this and mindful of the fact that we are judges and that we have taken an oath to uphold the Constitution and the laws of the state of Washington, and not wishing to violate our oath. But boy, we sure don't want to let that guy get the money.
Put it in trust. If he ever gets out, then you can use it.
Nothing in the statute about trust.
Can't we recess and pass another law?
But it may not be retroactive. Okay. It can only apply to future cases, and I assure you that particular problem has been taken care of in our statute. The legislature did it almost immediately. But it may not be retroactive. Well, shall we vote? Do you understand the responsibility you have? Just keep in mind the fact that you have sworn to uphold the Constitution of the United States, the state of Washington, and the laws which are appropriately passed by the legislative bodies. And nobody's argued that the legislature didn't have the right to pass this law. It's within their constitutional power.
Before we vote, have we decided there's any other law under this that can keep him from getting it?
No, but we're...
We vote the wrong way.
No, we haven't, but we're about to.
Okay.
Vern, is there anything that deals with the intent of the legislators?
Sure.
Any record that we could...
Sure. You betcha. A statute means what the legislators meant it to mean. Now, of course, the truth of the matter is all of you know who have watched legislation is that most legislators have never read the statute. I mean, I'm not trying to be funny about that. The thousands of bills that are introduced are sent out to committee, and the committee examines it, and the committee finally comes back, and they report to a caucus that the bill should be passed or ought not to be passed, and all the people in the caucus get in line, and they vote yes or no. That's a routine operation, except in extraordinary cases where everybody's got their wind up about something. Congress right now is talking an awful lot about abortion, for example, and I suppose that a lot of the people back there have read the proposed bills on abortion. They haven't read most of them. They couldn't. There isn't enough time, let alone be informed about them. So yes, but the legislative intent is what? And there isn't any intent of legislators. There is an intent of the legislature, which is sort of disembodied. And it walks around in English words out there, written on a piece of paper. And they have just sent it up to us, and they have asked us what they meant when they enacted this statute. And so we ask, well, what would they have meant when they enacted that statute? Or what do we say that they meant when they enacted that statute? And in response to the question which you people have rightly asked me, is there other law which says that a murderer shall not profit by his own wrong? I want you to see that we are about to decide that. We don't have anything that says so, but don't you feel in the pit of your stomach that there's a law someplace that says that a... But say more. Don't say there should be. Say there is.
Well, I would hope so.
Don't
you? I know
how. Your Honor.
There ought to be.
Your Honor, you are the law.
Must
we admit that, that we are about to make the law?
So then we are
going to interpret
law.
It to read this way.
We're going to interpret it, but if we're going to interpret it here, maybe it's going to be an interpretation which is based upon another law out there, which we have just discovered, which says that murderers ought not to profit by their own wrong. There are at least two primary sources of law, rules, what a lawyer would call rules, law. People call it all the time. Where do these rules come from? One is, it comes from enactments of legislative bodies, Congress, legislatures, city councils, you know, anybody that's authorized to make rules. And the other one is what we call the common law. Now, what in the world do you suppose the common law is?
It's a compendium of all the law decisions made by judges through the beginning of the United States.
Decisions. And do you suppose that the judges make these rules, or are they announcing rules which are already in existence in the society and the culture in which they live?
It's his interpretation.
The judge looks out and he says, what do the people in this society, what are their norms? What is normative? What do the people do? What are their customs? And then the judge gazes up at the clouds and he says, aha, I now know what the law of this people is. Not because the legislature has reduced it to print, but because his honor has correctly sensed the normative principles which motivate this society. And then he says, that's the law. Think for just a moment, my brethren on the bench, what we can do here. We can say that the society in which we live doesn't want murderers profiting by their own act. And we can say that that law is a built-in exception to all the legislation. The legislature did not expressly say that murderers could claim an award of lieu of homestead. There is this principle existing out there in the common law, and therefore it automatically is an exemption. Do you feel dirty? Do you feel like we've just done something that we didn't do back there with the incompetent son? Do you think that our society really would have the incompetent son recover the money? Should we have done the same thing with the incompetent son? Or is it more important that we adhere rather rigorously to the words of the legislature, unless we can find a real screamer out here on the side? We took our vote, we didn't let the murderer recover the award in lieu of homestead. But what I want you to see is that in this process, we, the judges, went through a real soul-searching process as to what the expectations are. We tell ourselves we didn't make it up. We now have before us a terrible bind, because one of the important jobs of law is to tell people what is acceptable and what is unacceptable. Precedent. You rely on it. You conduct your life on it. A pitcher who stands up on the mound and is about to throw a ball wants to believe that if he gets it below the shoulders, above the knee, and within the outside edges of the bag, that that's going to be a strike. Now, somebody's got to tell him. It's no fair for the referee to say, that time I was just thinking of a little bitty one in the middle. And then the next pitch says, that time I was thinking of a great big one, you know. You've got to be able to anticipate what the rules are and judge yourself and your future conduct accordingly. So it's a very important principle that expectations not be changed, that precedent be followed. When you've announced it one way, that's the way it is, so that people can rely on it. Well, what happened if they kept changing what's a valid deed or what constitutes a crime? Suppose that somebody says, I'm going to play a game with the stoplights. Today you stop on red, tomorrow you stop on green, then we're going to have 3 days of red, then we're going to have 2 days of green, and I'm not going to tell anybody about it. Except for the fact that the motorcycle policemen would be much more productive than they normally are, you know. It's a firm principle that you've got to have precedent that's reliable and doesn't change. And of course, as we have just demonstrated with our decision, it's a very firm principle that every case ought to do justice with the individuals who are before the court, and the law ought to operate, the process ought to operate, so that it does justice in that case. In other words, individuated justice in every case, firmly predictable and without variation. And as some of you have heard me say last week, if you were here, that's structured schizophrenia. And that is a very important step in the legal process. We have about 4 minutes, and then you will know all about how law operates. And the last important step that I want you to see is that we ask our judges to do several jobs at the same time. We ask them to do a didactic teaching job, tell us what we may do and what we may not do, write the law large, where we can all read it, where we can all be guided, do justice in the individual case by adjusting it. Now, once upon a time in the development of our legal system, those two functions were divided between two people. One was the law judge. The law judge in early England and in other societies, you know, our law and our parliament really comes from Scandinavia, not from England. Norway is the mother of parliaments, not England. It got processed through England. That's a diversion. I don't have time to divert. In those earlier days, the judge always adhered rigidly to the announced law. If it resulted in what you might think of as being gross injustice in the individual case, I mean, if the murderer got the $10,000, you didn't have to worry because he wouldn't really get it. Because judges then and now, acting in their capacity as law judges, do not order anybody to do anything. They simply announce facts. The plaintiff is entitled to the $10,000. The defendant will go to jail. That's not an order. That's just announcing a fact. Then if you think that you shouldn't, for example, if you've been ordered to be executed and you think that's a mistake, and you probably will, one of the things that you can do is to go to the governor in the state of Washington today and say, Governor, you know what they're going to do to me? And the governor might, in his sovereign power, say, even though the law says that you're going to be executed, I now grant you a pardon. or I stay the process, because it would be wrong in the individual case. So in the early development of the law, the king always had the right to vibrate the feeling of injustice, because he was not only the head of the secular government, but he was also the head of the church. And he did what he had to do as the secular government, and then he quivered with indignation at what the secular judgment had just done, and said, as a churchman, I refuse to let you do it. It reminds me a little bit, every time I think of it, of Poobah in the opera Mikado, you know, the guy who was everything. Well, the king couldn't listen to all of these outrageous things, so he set up the chancellors, and the chancellors were the keeper of the king's conscience. And people would come around to the chancellor and say, let me try this on you and see whether you vibrate with injustice. And if the king's conscience, in the person of the chancellor, churchman, vibrated, it could be stopped. We in the United States have a constitutional provision which says that we have a wall of separation between secular government and the church. So we can't go talk to our clergymen anymore. And so instead of that, we have the judge, good old judge. Puts on this hat, he's the law. Puts on this hat, and he's in equity. And he says, I, as a judge of law, hereby order that the money be given to the murderer. And as chancellor, I refuse to let that judgment be enforced. That's the way the legal process works. And it calls for a great deal of integrity and careful thought and the best evidence that we can get and adherence to anticipated precedents and a sensitive feel about what your population thinks is right and wrong. The judge's job is to have his finger on society out there, protect every person from the majority while always doing what the majority thinks best. And the rest of this week I will illustrate some more if I can. All right,